Joining us today on the Innovative Ideas series is Douglas Holtz-Eakin, who served most recently as Director of Domestic and Economic Policy for the John McCain presidential campaign. Doug has also been a member of the Peterson Institute for International Economics, the Director of the Marsh Greenberg Center for Geoeconomic Studies, the Paul Volcker Chair in International Economics at the Council on Foreign Relations, and he was previously the sixth Director of the Congressional Budget Office, where he was appointed for a four-year term beginning in February 2003. Dr. Eakin also served for 18 months as the chief economist for the President's Council of Economic Advisors. Prior to that, he was a trustee professor of economics at the Maxwell School, Syracuse University, where he served as chairman of the Department of Economics and associate director of the Center for Policy Research. Today, Doug's going to be speaking with us about his new Manhattan Institute paper that makes the case for bipartisan health care reform in 2009. Doug, in your paper, you make the case that the stars have aligned for bipartisan health care reform, both from the Republican perspective and that there's a political justification for it from the Democrats' perspective, even though they're in charge, obviously, of the executive branch and Congress. Can you talk for a moment about what the logic is that could drive parties together for bipartisan health care reform?
I think the key is that on the Republican side, we now see recognition that health care reform is an imperative. Every candidate for the Republican nomination in this cycle had a health care reform plan. Republicans need a message that reaches out to the middle class, and the particular financial burdens they bear in health care is on that list. And so they have a clear political incentive to deliver something. Democrats, on the other hand, have the power and want to have the ability to say, gee, we got it done, and this is a lasting achievement. The only lasting achievements are bipartisan in nature, and so both parties have an incentive to get it together.
And advocates, and this is a very interesting issue that you raise in your paper, advocates of universal coverage usually assume, or they assert rather, that getting everyone into the system will automatically have a cost savings, either because we're spending less on people showing up in emergency rooms without insurance coverage, or because we identify people who don't have insurance coverage who may have high cholesterol, and down the line maybe they'll have a heart attack if they don't get the appropriate drug or treatment. You point out, on the other hand, that more coverage is going to be more expensive. Could you talk for a minute about your thinking there?
I think the key is this. Insurance is a financial product that shifts around the burden of the cost of total health care. It determines who actually pays the bill. But the bill is the bill. And so if we do move to universal coverage, we will put everyone in a system, but the underlying health care costs will continue to rise as they have for the past three decades. And so instead of making things cheaper, it's more likely that you'll get, one, people buying more services because they've got health insurance, and two, the cost of those services will continue to rise too fast for people to bear their costs. That, in the long run, will cause a reform to unravel. And I also believe there's a political dynamic. If you move instantly to universal coverage and people start buying more health services with their new coverage, you will empower the very people, the providers, the medical device companies, the drug companies. You will empower them to resist reforms that are needed to get the costs under control instead of simultaneously doing coverage and delivery reforms that get the cost growth under control.
Let's talk for a moment about the four principles that you outline for successful health care, successful bipartisan health care reform in your paper. Increasing value in health care delivery, expanding quality insurance coverage, making private insurance more affordable and accessible, and finally providing patients and physicians with better information about health care quality and pricing. What reforms, if you could just talk us through those issues, do you advocate for each principle?
Well, focusing on value is really the notion of getting the delivery system to provide higher quality care at the same cost or even lower cost, provide care that's coordinated and emphasizes prevention instead of a heavy emphasis on fee-for-service medicine that's usually acute care medicine done in a hospital setting. So the number one lever that we have to do that is to change the payment systems in Medicare in particular, to reward coordination, to focus on outcomes, and to, as a result, provide a broad incentive for the physician and hospital communities to get together and practice medicine in a different way. It's also true that we could just save some money in Medicare by focusing on fraud and other sorts of programmatic abuses, and that would free up money both in the delivery system reforms and in the program reforms to expand coverage. That's the second step, and it's important for Republicans especially to recognize that health insurance is a valuable commodity, and greater coverage is a good thing if it's done in a reasonable way. So it should be the case that value and reforms to delivery come first, expansions in coverage come second. Those coverage expansions can be financed in part by getting rid of the existing bias of federal policy against broader insurance. Right now we have a tax subsidy. We don't tax the value of employer-provided health insurance, and that subsidy biases against people who have insurance outside their employer, and it also is much more generous to rich people than poor people. We can reform that tax treatment by eliminating the exclusion and replacing it with a flat credit, and in the process, get rid of the sort of incentives for people to use too much health insurance and thus too much health care through the tax subsidy. Those are ways to get value, then get more insurance. And finally, it's important that we devote any additional government resources that are raised to private insurance. They were originally private resources. They came into the government. They should go back to private insurance. We shouldn't simply have a tax and spend policy on this. Those are three ways to make the system work a little bit better. But ultimately, none of this will succeed over the long term unless patients, their doctors, the device and drug companies can recognize value when they see it. And that means we have to have better information about which therapies work, which drugs are most effective, and we must share that information broadly through modern information technologies and the dissemination of research results. So there are four principles there. They are about getting the sequence right so we can get reform, get more coverage, and make it last.
Absolutely. This week, the Medicare trustees released, as they do annually, their long-term projections for Medicare. And as usual, they're the lookouts on in the crow's nest, crying about the iceberg on the horizon. That's long-term Medicare liabilities. And yet, you know, we know we're on this catastrophic collision course, and we're getting closer all the time. But at the same time, the administration and some members of Congress are talking about expanding access to a new public entitlement modeled on Medicare. Why is there this disconnect between what we hear every year from the Medicare trustees and a number of policymakers on both sides of the aisle who are concerned about the budget and not letting healthcare eat up the federal budget, and this idea that we can just keep expanding access to another entitlement?
Well, I think it reflects the mistaken view that additional coverage will somehow solve our problems. As we discussed earlier, it's unlikely to make our problems worse, not better. And I think it reflects the fact that policymakers have not come to grips with the fact that Medicare is in many ways the problem. Medicare has a Part A that pays hospitals, a Part B that pays doctors, a Part C that pays insurance companies, and a Part D that pays drug companies. Nowhere in there is a patient. Nowhere in there is a coordinated effort to make sure that patient stays healthy and avoids acute services. And nowhere in there is anything like a coordinated delivery system that rewards efficiency. That's the problem with American medicine. Medicare drives it. It pays for a practice pattern that's expensive and doesn't reward prevention. We need to move away from that model, not make it bigger.
Absolutely. And so for all policymakers, Republicans and Democrats, who care about expanding coverage in a fiscally responsible way through private insurance, we want to see that vibrant private market maintain its health. How do we get there from where we are today? Because I think, you know, people who want to move in a different direction towards a single-payer healthcare system or expanding government control of healthcare markets have just a very simple answer. They can just say, well, let's let government do more. What's the bridge, the talking points, the strategy that makes people feel comfortable that we can do it through a private means, we can do it through a fiscally responsible means, and we can use tools like competition and information, and as you talked about very eloquently earlier, reforming the tax code in a way that just doesn't make people, you know, roll their eyes up and go to sleep?
Well, I think the answer is to, in fact, demonstrate. Talking points are nice, but the best demonstration would be to show people effective reform. Now, it happens to be the case that I favor a state-based approach because there are states, Massachusetts, a very blue state, Utah, a very red state, and others that have undertaken health care reforms. So my approach is let the federal government do its part, reform the tax code, deal with Medicare, but then on the coverage part, put it in the hands of state government. That's a government effort. It's going to be harnessing private markets to meet state government goals, and let those efforts succeed or fail on their merit. People can then identify where things work and where they don't, and I think that will provide past the talking point, the evidence people need to rely on reformed private markets to enhance coverage for more Americans.
Do you think, if we could just stray a little bit from the topic, do you think welfare reform could be a potential model here for people to talk about and work from? Because you did have the states taking the lead. States like Wisconsin really came up with something that turned out later on to be something of a national model that then conservatives and liberals could kind of shake hands over and say, we recognize that we need to do something to reform the program. But because the governors took the lead and had responsibility, they had a comfort level that a bipartisan reform could be worked out that would make both sides happy.
I think there's a lot of merit in that view. Welfare reform took place after the states made a lot of efforts. and it was reliant upon the states for implementation. You look at what's gone on in the United States, many of the individual states have undertaken efforts, some successful, Massachusetts and Utah, I pointed out, some not so successful. California tried, didn't quite get it done, but those efforts have given first some real political reality to the effort to do health care reform. People know how to get it done in those states, and what they will do is provide an implementation path. We've already seen governors do it. We can mimic their efforts and supply them the tools they need to get it done.
That's terrific. Well, listen, Doug, thank you very much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
To listen to this podcast and other podcasts in the Innovative Ideas series, go to www.medicalprogresstoday.com and click on the podcast tab.